Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast.com. My name is Walter, and today we're going to talk about a hijacking. But it's probably not the hijacking that you think of. Now, typically, at least here in the United States, when you think hijacking, you think about the events of September 11th, 2001. This is not that hijacking. This is Ethiopian Airlines Flight 961 from November 23rd, 1996. This has a few unique items, little bits of data about it that make this quite a unique story. So that's part of the reason I wanted to cover it. To give you a little bit of a background, the flight 961, was operated on a Boeing 767-200ER. That aircraft, in typical design, can hold anywhere between 181 passengers up to 290 passengers. And it can fly 6,385 miles, nautical miles. That actually is a little bit of information that you're going to want to remember later on, because it actually does feature prominently in the events. So this particular flight, Ethiopian Flight 961, was on an original route. That routing was from India to Ethiopia, then on to Kenya, the Republic of Congo, Nigeria, and finally terminating in the Ivory Coast. So you can see, if you look at these points along on the globe, you'll actually see, I mean, this is quite the service. There were, as of the Ethiopia to Kenya part, there were 163 passengers and 12 crew on the plane. So the first leg went fine, the India to Ethiopia segment. That part went just fine. When they took off from Ethiopia heading to Kenya, that's when things started to go south. What happened was three men, after the plane took off, jumped up. They were sitting in the back of the plane, and they jumped up and they stormed the cockpit. They said that they had a bomb with them and that, you know, they were going to set the bomb off. It was later actually found that it was only a bottle of liquor wrapped up, and they kind of shoved it around, making people think it was a bomb. They also said that they had eight more hijackers with them that were interspersed within the other passengers that were in the back of the plane. That also later turned out to be untrue. Now this hijacking is strange for a few reasons. Any hijacking in itself is out of the ordinary, so it's going to be strange, but this one's a little different if you start looking into it. There were two hijackers that were in the cockpit. So, of course, I told you there were three hijackers. So two of them were in the cockpit. They initially beat up the co-pilot, and they actually got an axe and a fire extinguisher from the cockpit, and that's what they used for tools. So they beat up the co-pilot, and they sent him out of the cockpit. So you've got two hijackers that are in the cockpit, and the other hijacker is stationed near the cockpit door, you know, in the first class area. So, I mean, that in itself, you've only got three hijackers and they're all in one area. The other weird part is, after the initial hijacking, they pretty much left most of the passengers alone. I mean, okay, you're thinking about being on this really long flight. The thing is, they let the people in coach pretty much do whatever they wanted. When you think about it, it's a bit odd, because these people in coach, there was an interview that I read that said, you know, they basically did what they would normally do on a regular flight. The flight attendants, you know, handed out food and drink. The people talked amongst themselves. It was, they said, just like a normal flight for a few hours. So that in itself is just something that's even kind of hard to comprehend, especially since if you know about the events of September 11th and that hijacking, those people were, you know, terrorized from start to finish. Anyway, so that's the odd thing about this. You know, these people who were flying in the coach section of the airplane, they said they chatted, they ate, you know, they just carried on like normal. There was someone who was interviewed who was in the business class section, and the people from the hijacker who was in the front of the plane guarding the cockpit, he was giving people the evil eye, of course, you know, make them stay in their seats and everything. They were able to, at least people on the aisles, they were able to get up and about, you know, when they distracted that hijacker, or when the hijacker had turned to work to talk to the people in the cockpit. So it was almost business as usual. Now, remember earlier I said, think about that flying 6,385 nautical miles. Because the hijackers had actually read the onboard magazine from Ethiopian Airlines. Everyone, you know, one of the first things you do when you get on an airplane, or at least what I do, is you thumb through the onboard magazine. So, you know a little bit about the airline, you know a little bit about the flight, So that's what these hijackers did, and they saw in there that, you know, Ethiopian Airlines could fly from Ethiopia to Australia on a single tank, you know, without having to refuel. So they thought, you know, we're going to hijack this plane, we're going to demand that we go to Australia. That's what they did. Now, I know that I am an airline geek. Maybe you're an airline geek, maybe you're not. Typically, when pilots are going to, you know, take their journey out, whether they're flying, you know, from Phoenix to Flagstaff or from Orlando to Dallas, it doesn't matter. They're going to take on the fuel that they need. They're not going to fill up the plane. They're only going to take on the fuel that they need. So the pilots had only taken on what they needed for their journey. And personally, I actually do not know through the research if they only were going to take on enough fuel from Ethiopia to Kenya, or if they took it all the way through to Ivory Coast or somewhere in between. So remember, they had like six stops on this flight plan. So the hijackers sitting there demanding, we want to go to Australia. And the pilots are trying to reason with them. You know, look, we only took on the amount of fuel that we needed, so we don't have enough. But the hijackers just did not believe them. They said, you know, you're lying. You know, you're lying. You're going to say whatever you can to get this, you know, hijacking over with. So the pilots said, okay, fine, we'll do it, you know, but warn them, we don't have enough fuel. So the pilots took the plane up to 39,000 feet. And said that, you know, all right, we'll do what we can. Now, that's what the pilot said. Remember, the co-pilot was actually back in the first class cabin, or business class cabin, one of the two. And instead of, however, taking the plane on a route to Australia, what happened was, the pilot went ahead and started to go down the African coastline. He knew basically if they ran out of fuel in the open ocean, they were dead. There was nothing they could do. But if he could stay along the African coastline and kind of trick the hijackers for as long as possible, that, you know, there was a chance that they would come out of this alive. So he started down the African coastline and flew between Madagascar and Africa's mainland he was heading for the Comoro Islands. So that was, you know, that he's like, I probably have enough fuel to get down there, so I'll try to do that. Maybe we can make an emergency landing there. So for about 3.5 hours, you know, the flight went on pretty much as normal. Like I said, the people in coach, they weren't, you know, these people actually had taken over the plane actually never even checked on what was going on in the coach or you know, any place that they did not see. They were only there when the plane took off. So 3.5 hours into it, you know, they're going along, and all of a sudden one of the engines stops. And it stopped, of course, because it was out of fuel. So that aircraft, because of that, the pilot had to take the plane from 39,000 feet down to 24,000 feet. So hijackers, you know, looking out the windows can tell, hey, we're not over open ocean. We're actually, you know, I can still see land. So the hijackers realized what the hell, you know, what the heck was going on. And they threatened to detonate the bomb that they said they had. But the pilot basically said, you know, I'm sorry, but we just could not do it. And I told you, we've already lost one engine. We're going to lose the other one soon. So this is when the pilot got on the PA to let the passengers know about the situation. Of course, they already knew that they were hijacked. But he got on the PA and he went into what was going on. He told them that they were on a fuel shortage because, you know, they had lost the one engine. So that one engine was out. So they were only on a single engine at this point. So what happened was he got on this, you know, he warned the people, you're going to have to, you know, plan for an emergency landing because we're not going to have enough fuel to do anything else. So what happened was he said a few minutes later, and there were only two broadcasts over the PA to the passengers. So he actually gets on the PA a second time and says, okay, everyone, you're going to have to prepare for this emergency landing. You're going to put your life jackets on first. And I know there was some consternation in the business class cabin because no one could find the life jackets. They had to go on a hunt to find out where they were. So everyone puts on their life jackets. And, you know, then he said, once you have your life jackets on, you know, you're going to have to get into a bracing position because we are going to have to do an emergency landing. Now, at this time, he thought that possibly they were going to be able to make it to Gran Comoro and make this emergency landing. But, of course, that never really happened. So, all right. Everyone's, you know, basically has started to panic at this point because emergency landing. They have their life jackets on. The second engine finally goes out, fuel starved. So what the pilot has to do is he has to crank down the ram air turbine. And what that is if you think of it like a giant pinwheel, if you don't want to know what this wind turbine is, it actually will spin in the wind as the plane is flying and create some energy so that it can power some of the systems that are in the plane. So they had a rudimentary, you know, compass. They probably had a rudimentary airspeed indicator and things of that nature. So they had a few of their tools, but they didn't have all of them. You know, they didn't have flaps because that was a hydraulic system. And there's, you know, this little ram air turbine just did not create enough electricity to power those. So the pilot, and at this time the co-pilot, actually fought his way to get back into the cockpit. And so the pilot and the co-pilot were together in there, being, you know, the hijackers were there at the same time as well. You know, the hijackers realized, oh my God, he was actually telling the truth, you know, about the fuel. So they saw that the pilot had turned the plane so that it could line up with the runway at Gran Comoro. And he was attempting it. That's what the pilot was trying to do. But, you know, once the hijackers realized, you know, we're not going to get away with this, they basically wanted to take the plane and turn it into a giant bomb, like September 11th here in the United States. And they wanted to crash the airplane into a hotel on the island. So there was this huge fight between the pilots, the two pilots on the plane, and the hijackers. And in this fight, you know, they're moving around, the plane's moving around, gliding at this point, and the pilot loses sight of where the airport is. So they realize, you know, okay, we don't see the airport, we don't know where it is, we're going to have to actually ditch. So I believe the program is called, internationally it's called Mayday. Here in the U.S. it's called Air Emergency, and there is a program on this particular flight. One of the passengers, and I remember this from the program, I do not remember this, or I did not see this quoted anywhere else, that one of the passengers said that all of a sudden, when they realized they were going to be landing very soon, they went through these, all the, you know, several passengers went through and started inflating their life vests. And he started to call out, you know, stop, don't do it, you know, you can't do this right now, you have to wait till we're actually in the water to do it. So, but the thing is, many people still did this. They still inflated the life vests. And when you think about it, it was a really, really deadly decision on their part. It was really poor judgment. You do things when you panic. I understand that. But this basically cost these people their lives. So, all right. So we're getting ready to land in the water. We've got this emergency landing that's coming up. The captain sees that, you know, even while he's still fighting, he sees a patch of shallow water near the, and I'm going to probably butcher this pronunciation, but Le Galois Beach Hotel. So he sees this patch of water and he decides, I'm gonna go ahead and kind of bring the plane in for a landing there. So Captain Leo Abate, he attempted this. It would have been the original Captain Sully type of landing. That's the U.S. Airways flight that both engines were taken out and they landed, you know, it's called the Miracle on the Hudson, of course. So they attempted what would have been the first Miracle on the Hudson type landing. But the fight kept going on and the yoke was grabbed to one side. So the plane banked 10 degrees. In doing so, what happened was the wingtip, as you're looking at the airplane, facing the airplane, it would be the right-hand side. So the right wingtip touched first. It touched the water. And then after it did, there was a jerk, and the engine caught the water. And basically at that point, it was all over. So as soon as that right-hand engine started scooping in water, it caused the plane to jerk really, really violently. The survivors of the airplane crash said that first touch, you know, when it was just the wingtip, it wasn't that bad. You know, it was a little jarring, but not much. The second, and that would have been the engine touching basically starting to scoop in the water, when the engine basically was in the water. That was really, really hard. And then when there was a third basic jolt, you know, it was wingtip, engine, and then the plane. And one of the passengers said it felt like, you know, coming to a complete stop in a car crash when you had been doing 70 miles an hour. It felt like that. It was that bad. So, all right, so the plane dipped, turned slightly in the shallow water, and it crashed. It broke up into three major pieces. Two of those three pieces began to sink. As they were flying in, as they were, you know, coming into land, it actually, and I was kind of surprised that I'd never heard this, there was actually a group of first-time scuba divers from the Gran Camaro, from one of the hotels there, a little tourist trip, that the plane barely missed them as they were coming in. And they were there. It was first time scuba diving class. They were taking a class. So this plane, you know, broke up into three major pieces. Now, what I said earlier, the people that put their life jackets on and inflated them, they were trapped. I mean, think of it this way. You are in underwater. And if you're in the tail of the plane, thinking this is just theoretically, if you're in the tail of the plane and the tail is basically up in the air and the front part of that tail is underwater, so you're at an angle. If you have an inflated life jacket, you cannot swim down so that you can come back up. You just can't do it. If you're wearing an inflated life jacket, you can if you're not. So, you know, basically all these people, they were basically trapped, you know. You know, a lot of them had to swim certain ways to get out, and an airplane is not going to be like an airplane. An airplane in the water is not going to be like an airplane, you know, on the ground. It's going to be at different angles. So they had to swim different angles to be able to get out of the plane. They couldn't do it because they had these life jackets that were you know, inflated around them. So they were trapped. The rescuers later on, because the lucky thing is, like I said, the captain managed to land not too far off the beach and in shallower water. The rescuers actually described that there were people that were basically being held in their seats or held in certain areas of the plane because of the life jackets. Now, like I said, panic makes you do stupid things, and these people actually did a stupid thing in inflating their life jacket, and it cost them their lives. That's why, to this day, if you're on a plane that has life jackets and you hear the safety briefing, you'll notice they stress, do not inflate your life jacket until you are outside of the plane. And that's actually a result of this particular airline crash. Luckily, and if you want to call it lucky, because there's nothing lucky about a plane crash other than surviving it, there was actually a convention of physicians that were, you know, they were doing a convention on the island of Gran Comoro at the time. That was, you know, just utter and pure luck. So there were physicians there that could help those that survived. There were a couple that were on the beach, you know, just relaxing, enjoying their free time at the convention. And the woman thought, as she's videotaping her husband or whomever, her partner, whatever it was, whoever it was, thought, well, this low-flying 767, you know, this large aircraft, this must be part of the air show, you know, must be something special for the convention. So she was videotaping this. So she actually videotaped the plane crashing into the low surf at this point, which makes this one of the most visible airline crashes of all times. So it is lucky that we had that. So you could see how the plane was landing, how it crashed, broke into three, and see how these people were able to get out, you know, find the sections that where people were able to get out of and not. It was, you know, if you look on YouTube, and actually I'll post a video of it on catastrophecast.com, it was, you know, it was one of the deadliest hijackings in history. And technically it was the first hijacked aircraft that ever did a water landing, and one of the only times that a wide-body jet has landed on the water and actually had survivors. So, in all, after this crash was, you know, after the crash was done, people started heading out, they started heading towards the survivors, and they started, you know, rescuing folks. In all, there were 175 people on that airplane, you know, 163 passengers, 12 crew. 123 of those people died. Many of them did die as a result of the impact. All three of the hijackers were killed. Several other people were killed as a part of the impact itself. There was also a man named Mohammed Arman, or Amen, I believe. And he was actually a famous photojournalist. So he actually was a famous photojournalist. He actually did take pictures for Ethiopian Airlines in-flight magazine as well. And people think that he was actually, based on what the survivors recounted, he was actually negotiating with the hijackers. So those people were standing up at the time of the crash, and they did die. So there were a large number of people, like I said, who were trapped in their seats, who were trapped in their inflated life jackets, you know, made them become a buoy in the aircraft and not be able to escape it. So 123 people died. It was just a massive number that of what looked like somewhat of a survivable crash. As a little after note, the pilot and the co-pilot actually still to this day continue to fly for Ethiopian Airlines. They were honored by several organizations for their actions in this hijacking and crash. You know, they did some incredible things, and they saved a great deal of people. Captain Abate actually won what is Flight Safety Foundation's their Professionalism in Flight Safety Award in 1997. And he's actually one of probably only, I'd say less than 20 people, just glancing over the webpage, that has actually won this award in the nearly 20 years that this award has been, actually 30, almost 30 years, that this award has been given out. So that's something that actually not even Captain Sullenberger from U.S. Airways, the Miracle on the Hudson, so it's something that not even he won. These people, you know, were dedicated to their job, and they did what they had to save their passengers, and they were rewarded for it. So, that covers the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 961 hijacking and crash. If you have ideas about what you'd like to have covered in a future podcast, I would gladly love to hear from you. You can go ahead over to our webpage at catastrophecast.com and send us an email. You know, there's a contact button. Or you can send us an email at podcast@catastrophecast.com. Thanks for listening.